This conference is being recorded.
Hello, and welcome to the Heart Start to Your Week, Monday, March 10th, 2008. That little beep beep that you just heard is somebody muting their phone. So if you're live on this call, I'm going to ask everyone except for Lisa, who is a guest of honor this evening. We're going to be doing an interview that I'm really looking forward to tonight. And I'd ask everybody else just to star six, and that will mute out your phone so that background won't be a distraction for other people. And, of course, if you're listening to this as a recording, we're so happy here at Fiera to make this service accessible to you. Fiera is the company hosting tonight's call, and Fiera is also a word created to describe a feeling. That feeling that you get when you really feel great inside. It could be peaceful, it could be exuberant, either one. But it's a feeling, a heartfelt feeling of passion and joy for your life, of compassion for suffering your own and that of others, and of a sense of inner power and inner knowing that you can make a difference. We used to say in shorthand, Fiera is that great feeling you get when your arms slip over your head and yes to life flies out of your mouth. And that's what we do here at Fiera. We use a step-by-step scientific process which teaches people how to tap the benefits of that feeling, not just to feel better, but because feeling better is also better for you. We have data that it's good for your health. It's good for your performance. It's good for your communication and your relationships. It affects everything from how your toes work to how your nose works. It affects your brain function, your immune system, your hormones. And feelings don't just happen to us, it turns out, that we can actually be at cause for creating and generating positive feelings that then yield a whole cornucopia of benefits for us in every area of our lives. And for the people around us. And so these Heart Start to Your Week calls are all about how to tap into that benefit in a particular area. And tonight's call is how to tap into that benefit for the sandwich generation, which, this one really touches my heart because, well, I'm not personally sandwiched in the way that so many are, and the sandwich generation, by the way, is a phrase that was coined, for those who aren't familiar, to describe people who are caught in the middle of generations, people who have aging parents that require their care, as well as young children or teenagers that require their care. So they're sandwiched between two needy generations, and they're responsible for it all, or at least it can feel that way. And this generation has all kinds of unique stressors that the heart can help. And the heart is what we teach people to access as a source of Sierra, that great feeling and all the benefits it brings, better decision-making, better communication, better understanding, all these things that can help someone who's in the sandwich. And this one is really close to my own heart because when I hit puberty, my grandmother, all of my grandparents actually went into simultaneous crisis. One of my grandfathers died. My grandmother, who was married to him, was diagnosed with severe and quickly accelerating Alzheimer's disease. And my grandfather on the other side of the family had a heart attack that same year, and my grandmother, who was married to him, had cancer. So you get the picture. Basically, you have a prepubescent teen, and anybody who's a parent of a teenager can imagine, especially those of you that know me. One person on this call knew me when I was a teenager. You know what I was putting my mother through, Lisa. And so not only was my mother dealing with me, but dealing with losing her support system in her own family and having to become their source of support. It's huge, right? A total crisis point for many, many people. And, you know, as if the emotional stress of that were not enough, which of course is Imagine, you know, suddenly you're accountable to everybody and nobody's there to support you. You're raising everyone, and you've lost something huge in your life, right? If your parent has Alzheimer's, in the case of my grandmother, we just watched her kind of disappear and become this shell, which was devastating to all of us in our own way, but of course devastating to my mother, right? Her mother. And so not only is there that, but then there's just the logistical stressors that are incurred, like the bills to be paid, because suddenly there's one breadwinner for 8 people. And those 8 people have medical needs and ballet school needs. Right? One group is going out the door and the other group's cultivating itself, and both are a financial burden as well as a bandwidth burden in terms of just decisions to be made and things to be done and challenges to meet. And so from watching my mother deal with this issue with so much poise and grace, and watching my grandmother sort of evaporate who she was, this one really touches my heart, and I'm committed here at FEERA to really offer services that can benefit people who are stuck in a sandwich generation. And the inspiration for this call is the woman that knew me when I was a teenager and knew our family through that process, my ballet teacher, who I feel so incredibly privileged to have with us on the call tonight, because she's going to share at a certain point here some of her own experience of how applying the tools that she learned in the FEERA curriculum, the heart math technology, which we're going to talk about now, helped her and is helping her as a member of the sandwich. And so HeartMath is a research institute as well as a for-profit corporation and a nonprofit service organization all rolled into one in Northern California that has been researching the physiology of stress for the last 15 to 20 years. And in researching the physiology of stress, they've been able to develop tools and technology that can reverse the negative effects of stress in our bodies and our minds and our emotions. And here's the key piece of information that HeartMath discovered that put them on the map and that allows us to do what we do, because HeartMath has licensed us to teach this piece of science and to represent them in offering their tools and technologies to you so that you can learn how to benefit from this scientific discovery. And what they discovered is that stress, while there are 1,400 things that happen in your body in a stress reaction, that one of the things that's a significant portal of potential for us to reverse that is stressful emotions cause a chaotic pattern in the heart's rhythm. I'm just going to say that again. Stressful emotions cause a chaotic pattern in the heart's rhythm. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean just because somebody cut you off on the freeway, you go into a fibrillation? No, that's not what that means. So you don't have to worry about that. What that means is that your heart has changes in its beat, in its rhythm, beat-to-beat changes in the pattern of its rhythm. Just like a song, different songs have different rhythm structures. And when you get a whole group singing a song, then they're all in tune or in harmony. But if one person starts singing Jingle Bells while everybody else is singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat, suddenly there's not harmony. And then you get static. In essence, this is what HeartMath discovered that stress is. It's internal static, where our body systems are no longer working in confluence with one another. So you've got an orchestra, but they're all playing different symphonies. And what you want is you want everybody to agree, okay, we're all going to play Beethoven's Ninth right now. When we feel good, when we feel fiera, what's actually happening is all the body systems are working together in sync. And positive emotions like love, appreciation, care, compassion, right? So it doesn't have to be like, woohoo, I'm so excited and happy, because for the sandwich generation, there's plenty that happens that's not to be happy about. Plenty of challenges, but you can learn how to maintain your own, what we call coherence, by self-adjusting your heart rhythm in that situation, which makes your brain work better so you can make decisions better or see possibilities where you couldn't before. It makes your immune system work better so you're less susceptible to the to the colds and bugs and flus that your toddlers are bringing home from preschool or that your aging parents have in the nursing home. So you can pull the all-nighters you have to take care of everybody and still maintain your immunity. These types of things, right? It keeps you working in harmony with yourself and therefore creating more harmony around you. And while that's all really crucial and probably the main thing that gets people in the door to take my classes, the thing that inspires me the most about teaching this material is it also allows you to still have a heart connection with people through the stressors that you encounter, even people who've literally lost their thinking mind, like my grandmother with Alzheimer's. But it's still possible to be in the loving family connection with somebody as they're going through these stages of life. That, to me, is where the real juice is for me personally in offering these tools, which is why I wanted to bring my teacher, Lisa, on tonight, because she's been so diligent and fabulous about applying what she learned in challenging situations, and the payoff in her stories has been inspiring to me personally. Made me so wish that I had had these tools when I was 13 years old and with my grandmother and my mother through the tribulations of that. It would have changed our whole experience, I know. We would have found pockets of joy and pockets of love inside of the challenge. And certainly those showed up, but it's so much more powerful to be at cause for them and create them intentionally rather than just having them happen by accident or serendipity on occasion, to know that you could get up every day and be a cause for connecting and loving is really, really powerful and amazing. And of course, how great then, you know, it's better for your immune system and you think better and you make better decisions and all that good stuff that is a result of that. Before I open up the line and bring Lisa in to share her experience of this, I want to share a story that someone told me this weekend. Because really the point of this and why our tools work is that stress is not circumstances, and that's really good news for the sandwich generation, because when you're in the sandwich, the circumstances can be pretty bleak at times. But the great news here, and what it is that I've really said up till now, is that stress is not circumstances. When, the phrase stress is a relatively new phrase, and when it was first coined, they didn't even know how to define it. You don't read Shakespeare or Chaucer, just don't pick up Hamlet and it says, to stress or not to stress. It's just not the question, right? It's not what's going on there. They don't even use that word in the vernacular until like the 1950s. And a man named Hans Selye invented the word stress. Obviously, he didn't invent the experience, but he definitely invented the word. And since then, stress has become a global epidemic. The American Institute of Stress suggests that 97% of all doctors' visits are related to stress. That's huge. Stress is the opposite of fiera, if we're going to define it fully, right? So fiera is the opposite of stress, which means stress is raw material for making fiera, actually. because it's the soil we can grow that in. And I want to share a story with you that I heard this weekend about someone doing that, someone in the sandwich generation. When they coined the phrase stress, they defined stress as having to quickly change focus multiple times in a short period of time. Okay, so think 1940s, 1950s, multiple focus changes in a short period of time. How many focus changes? Just think about this for yourself for a moment. How many focus changes do you think was high stress in 1950 in an hour? Anybody want to unmute themselves and take a guess?
I would say three. It's Lisa, three or four.
You're close, Lisa. Now tell me this. Have you, you know, in an average hour in your day-to-day, you don't need to change focus more than four or five times, do you?
Maybe four or five times every minute.
Yeah, exactly. As a matter of fact, it's more.
Oh, God.
With cell phones, pagers, fax machines, split-screen TVs, internet, instant messaging, an average person is changing focus more than 30 times, 30 to 60 times in 1 minute. Now, right? In 1950, they thought 10 focus changes in an hour was high stress. Now, obviously, for those mothers on the phone.
No, yeah, that couldn't be true.
You get that they obviously were not interviewing mothers. Remember, all research, all medical research originally was done on the standard man, right? Literally a man. So they weren't interviewing women at that time who were mothers. 10 focus changes an hour, high stress. Not, can't define it that way anymore. Because our technology has required of us to adapt to much higher speed change. So how it has evolved in our understanding is that stress is not about circumstances. It's not about focus changes. It's not about the demands of life outside of us. It's about how we respond to it. You get that? Because why could one person be in a highly high-speed changing environment and respond fine and another person collapse? Or how could one person be raised in a family and end up a distraught mess and another person be raised in the exact same environment and end up on top of their game, or okay, or whatever language you want to use for that? Obviously, it's complex, and there's lots of elements at play, but what it tells us is stress is not in the circumstances, it's in the internal response to them. And that's such good news, because we can change our response, and we cannot always change our circumstances. However, and this is the payoff of the tools, even in the beginner course that we teach, which is the only one that Lisa's taken. I can't wait to hear from you on this, Lisa. Even in the beginner course that we teach, you start to see that you're a part of the equation of the circumstances. So if you change your response, the circumstances automatically have to change. They just constellate themselves around you differently. So what we do here is we teach you to change your response to circumstances and empower you to change circumstances that way. And it's not like we own the intellectual property of changing response, right? There's so much great stuff out there that does this. As a matter of fact, someone was thanking me when we first got on the phone because they referred all you guys who are listening to Oprah's fabulous webinar with Eckhart Tolle, who I absolutely adore. So there's lots of wonderful, wonderful stuff out there that helps people do that, right? And so, but I just come alive when I hear people accessing that. And the science that HeartMath and other heart brain research institutes have come up with is that whatever technology you use, whatever self-growth or personal development process you use to tap into that, what you're tapping into when you take the power to respond to life rather than react, you're accessing the power of the heart when you do that. That's what I mean when I say, from here on out, heart intelligence. And so we teach people to access the, there is literally a brain in the heart, a guidance system in there. So when you're losing your parents, the mentors in your life, and you need to know what to do, here's the good news. You've got a guide inside at the center of your chest. Literally a brain. A brain that's sending signals to the heart, just like a GPS directs your car, that would help tell you, turn right here, go left there, take this action, choose this nursing home. And we teach people tools for assessing those crisis decisions with heart intelligence so that you're not just doing it conceptually or logistically or logically, but you're bringing the heart's value to it, which is your care for the people involved. And the results of that are phenomenal. And I was really touched, probably because I was keyed into the fact we were going to do this call tonight, by I participated myself in a seminar this weekend, and the seminar leader spoke about his mother and his mother's relationship to his father who had Alzheimer's. And I just appreciate so much that the intelligence of the heart is right here in all of us. I needed tools and technology to tap into it because my stress static was so loud that I couldn't even tune my dial anymore. It was like my fist just kept hitting the radio going, this thing is broke. I needed a way to realign myself with the heart. But some people just spontaneously, naturally find this. It is your birthright. And there was a woman, this man's mother, who didn't have our training. She had other training. And what she did was every day her husband would ask her 60 to 70 times, what day is it? All day long, because obviously he had Alzheimer's, right? So all day long, what day is it? What day is it? What day is it? The seminar leader approached his mom when they were visiting, and he was just like ripping his hair out, right? And he had tools, not our tools. He was using other tools, and he's just like ripping his hair out. He said, Mom, how can you stand this? This is driving me nuts. What day is it? Monday. What day is it? Monday. And she just said to him, well, yeah, you know, I'd definitely prefer to hear a different question, to be able to offer, you know, a different answer. But she said, to tell you the truth, I really don't mind it that much because he asked me a question. It's the one moment of the day when I get to talk to my husband. In other words, it's not the words we're exchanging, it's the heart connection that we're still sharing. This just gives me chills to say that to all of you. I don't know if I was able to communicate really the full power of my experience of hearing that, but that's the power of the heart. That she could still feel joy inside of it, an experience where her own husband didn't even recognize her, and feel joy in connecting with him and make the heart the priority rather than the context. It puts the diamond first rather than the setting. The setting is our language. The setting is, you know, our daily activity. But the diamond is the heart. It's our connection. And she was a stand for her continued connection with this man. And so as a result, she could meet that circumstance that what most for most of us, what for me personally, would be an incredibly stressful circumstance without stress. Because she brought her love to it, if you will. And it sounds idealistic until you know that love is something we can measure and care is something that we can actually create. You don't have to just know how to do this. that when the heart rhythm is brought into this ordered pattern, so in other words, if stress creates chaos in the heart, love and care create order in the heart. And when you learn to train your heart muscle to beat in this ordered, harmonious pattern, what you experience as a result is care, is love, is seeing life in a different way, is seeing stressful circumstances as opportunities or points of connection. Right? And so that's what I feel, Lisa, you've so courageously stepped in to do in the situation that you're in. You know, and I want to open up the call for you to share your own experience of even discovering that you needed the tools and applying them and using them and anything at all that you want us to know. You know,
how far back should I go?
Well, you could go as far back as 1984 when I met you, right?
Well, no. Well, maybe I'll go back to my midlife crisis. my story. Well, these things, I always knew there would be a point in our lives because my husband and I were married relatively late. You know, I was 30, which is, you know, I guess becoming the norm these days, but 20 years ago it really still wasn't. And I didn't have my daughter until I was 41.
Love that.
So I knew there would be a point in her life where relatively young, she would probably be without any grandparents. We knew this was coming. Mm-hmm. And so that's just the way it was. You know, we just knew it was coming. And we also knew that, interestingly as well, that there would be a point where, because of our ages, my husband and I would be heading into retirement when she would be going off to university. So we're looking at that, too. And that's another thing. But it was probably when I came to you, it was all from a period, very, very long period of stress that I felt incapable of changing. I had been, about 6 years ago, I had been teaching at an institution that I always thought would be there for the rest of my life. And it was increasingly becoming unfulfilling and not the best place to be. I didn't feel that it was, I mean, it was a people-oriented service, as dance it should be. It's about the people. And it was becoming increasingly about the corporate bottom line. And so I was going through a real sort of artistic crisis. And for me to go through that, that's how I define myself. I've been doing it all my life. And so to go through that kind of feeling that I wasn't doing anything worthwhile, and that's how it shaped my whole life, was really serious. And I was also realizing that I was hitting what should have been the peak of my teaching career, and I didn't see it going anywhere because of the institution I was in. Mm. So at that point, I decided to open my own school. So, you know, at 6 years...
So you had two children.
Yeah.
A child and a business.
A new business. You know, a new business, totally self-employed. And I knew it was going to be a lot of work and an uphill battle. But I've never been afraid of work. That's never been an issue for me. That's, you know, can be a workaholic, and that's not a problem. So that has been good. But it was a big crisis. It was like after, you know, a total of 22 years with one organization, which is unheard of in our business, really, I was essentially having to have a divorce. A career divorce.
Yeah,
that's what it felt like. So it was massive. And
which is not uncommon, right? Just to interject,
for people
in the sandwich generation to either divorce a career or divorce a partner in the midst of the crisis, because the stressors are, you know, it's also that middle age point is definitely a turning point in everybody's life. So they're definitely dealing with their own crisis in addition to everybody else's.
I also think, too, at that point, you know, being in my sort of late 40s, it was also a matter of me watching grandparents age, seeing my daughter grow up and going, hey, wait a minute. You know, in 20 years, I'm going to want to hope to partially retire or something. And 'cause heaven knows what it'll be by the time that hits with, you know, the economy the way it is. But if I want to know, I can. Or I want to know, more importantly, that I've made a mark. I've done something that I can be proud of. And I didn't feel that where I, the situation
I
was in.
Mm-hmm.
Did someone speak up? No. I didn't feel that that was ever going to happen, and I had to make it happen. I had to create the circumstances for me, at least to fulfill my personal vision for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a long process, a lot of work. It was a very stressful thing because I'm a bit of a control freak. And, and you know, that was a very stressful thing to give up what I felt like was financial security. And interestingly, it hasn't turned out to be any different. I have the same financial security 6 years later that I had then.
Mm.
Nothing's different.
So cool.
It's interesting. But now I have the potential for growth, and it's interesting that I didn't feel that way. So that was a huge stressor. And then in the midst of all that, I was, you know, talking to my dad and seeing my mom. I'm going, Mom, Dad, there's something wrong with Mom, and there has been for a long time. There just really is something wrong. You've got to take her to a doctor. And, you know, with his generation being in his late 70s at the time, they believe all doctors are gods, and the doctor they currently have says, oh, it's just old age. That happens to all of us. I'm going, no, Dad, it doesn't. Not that way. No, no, you've got to get her assessed. And they sort of put the blinkers on and didn't really take care of matters. Till finally it came to a crisis. My dad had always had a drinking problem. He was, you know, an alcoholic. And one day he called me up, and of course I live in Nova Scotia, and they live in Ontario. And he phoned me up very, very drunk, saying that there was nothing left to live for, and he was going to end it all. And I said, "What the hell is going on? Excuse my language, but what's going on here? What are you really saying? What's going on? Where's Mom?" And he did finally pass the phone on to her, and she was crying and really couldn't be coherent, and I knew something was very, very wrong. So I called my sister, who lives, you know, who at that point lived about an hour away from my parents, and I said, you have to go down there. Get in the car. And it was interesting that my dad phoned me rather than my sister. I mean, I was halfway across the country. At that point, there was very little I could do except to, you know, get on the phone and scream at my sister to go to my parents' house. So she got there, but it was eventually they found, and I insisted at that point in time that my sister had to find my parents a new doctor. She just had to. And I was going to keep nagging until they did. And they eventually did find him a new doctor, who then very quickly assessed, as I thought, that Mom had Alzheimer's.
Mm.
But at that
point, essentially what I hear you saying, Lisa, is that their fight was somehow a breakdown in him being able to see that she had a disease and
mm-hmm.
her being overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
And him taking her disease personally.
He was taking it personally. He just kept complaining that she was stupid.
Yeah.
And I'm going, Dad, she's not stupid. There's something wrong. There are many reasons to have dementia. Some, you know, there's medication. You can solve this. You can do things. You don't have to live this way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was also fear. It was fear of the diagnosis, of knowing what But in doing that, they really did shorten the time they had together. Because she went for several years with no medication that could have stalled the disease.
Well, not to mention from our perspective, right, the way you described her when she was crying was incoherent.
Mm-hmm. She was already there.
Right. We know because coherence facilitates the higher brain,
mm-hmm.
right? So being in that emotional discord and being judged and being in the fear, we know whether it accelerates the Alzheimer's disease or not, it gives all of us temporary Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
Why smart people do when they're stressed out, right?
Yeah.
They shut down their brain. So being in the emotional chaos actually can amplify the stressors of the disease and the symptoms of it. Yeah.
I also think part of it, too, is just my dad's behavior. I know you've coined the phrase a rageaholic, but my dad was as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's partially that generation of men who don't know how to process their emotions. I mean, I certainly don't see it as prevalent in the men that I know that are my age. Nor my husband's father, who's as calm and accepting as he's unbelievable. But I found there was a lot of men of that generation who did not know how to process their emotions in any way whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was one of them. And he dealt
with it. Well, so you can start to see the key to emotions is really the key to unraveling stress, because emotions are the portal that stress enters or leaves.
Yeah.
And so gaining mastery over emotions is really what we teach people how to do here, especially in our year-long course, Heart Mastery. It's where there's that absence of relationship to emotional energy that you can end up in this cesspool that you're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm. And, of course, his way to deal with it was always alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Right. So without knowing what to do with emotion, he self-medicated with addiction,
mm-hmm.
which is what so many people do, right?
Mm-hmm.
We actually did a call specific on addiction because this is so effective for getting to that. So we get the picture of the setup here. It's a setup for disaster.
It's definitely a setup for disaster. It was also set up, I mean, for a long time we've been asking my parents to move out of the environment they were in. They were in a section of Toronto that had changed radically since I was a kid and was now very much one of the worst sections of the city. They had to get out. We had been trying to get them to move for I don't know how long. So luckily at that point, it was about 5 years ago, my parents did actually move up closer to my sister, which was into a small rural community. And I can't tell you how fabulous that was for them. It gave them a network of neighbors and people to watch. And it's that was a fabulous thing that, you know, they finally...
Again, so it's giving them some source of fiera in their life, right? Some heart connection.
And I do think...
That's so healing and medicinal just to have that in any way. And if you're listening to the call tonight and you don't feel like you have that community support, that's what these calls are for. So we will open up the line in, you know, 10 or 15 minutes for your questions, you know, including the community. And that's definitely what this is about. So, yeah, go ahead, Lisa.
So, you know, things progressed until finally, you know, a year and a half ago, it got so difficult for my dad, who had never really cooked his own meals, never really done the laundry. You know, I was trying to suggest, my sister and I suggesting ways, you know, have meals on wheels and those kinds of, you know, have a cleaning lady. You don't need to do this. You've got enough money, you know, in retirement. You can do this. Make your life easy. And they managed for a while that way, to the point, though, where the last time I was at the house when my mom was still there, is she came out of the bathroom, and my husband and my daughter were with me at the time when we were there, and she wandered out of the bathroom stark naked, not knowing where the bedroom was.
Mm.
And I said, Dad, it's time. You know, if she's wandering like this and you don't know if she's going to do it in the middle of the night, you know, you can't take care of her anymore. It's time. They finally, that was Christmas, finally at the end of January, they had found a place for her in a nursing home. And I think he felt a lot of guilt when that happened. I think the last few years had been enormously stressful on him. And so from January, I mean, on the surface he sounded like he was coping and he was better, but he would spend hours and hours and hours up there trying to visit her, I think out of a feeling of guilt that he had to be there because he had put her away.
Mm.
And
so just for if everybody could pause for a moment and get the compassion of that, just what you feel and,
you know,
for this person who's in this scenario where they have no choice in a way, and yet what their mind does with the choice that they're making is to feel responsible for something that they can't necessarily be responsible for. That just the compassion of that as it hits me, I just wanted to share that for a moment because compassion is a heart feeling. And these calls are experiential as well as, you know, conceptual. You guys are getting information, but I also want the listeners to receive an experience of the heart, you know. Just the compassion for a person who has to be in that situation. Clearly very painful, and not sympathy, right? Because sympathy drags you down. It's draining. Compassion elevates you and the people around you. So just a moment of compassion. So thank you, Lisa. I just wanted to point
that out. So simultaneous to that, at about this time last year, Chris's mother was diagnosed with cancer in her liver and her kidneys. And She was 83 at the time. And we, you know, she had a little bit of, you know, care. It was, they deemed it was, it happened so quickly, and which is a blessing, I think. It's an incredible blessing. It happened so quickly that they decided not to try and treat it, and because it was just so throughout her body. That actually, I think, and so on May 30th last year, she passed away. I still have a hard time talking about it. But she passed away at home, and everybody was there. And it was really quite an amazing. It was really an amazing passing with great dignity. It was really amazing. And she knew it was happening. She had prepared for it. She prepared everybody else for it. I could not believe how elegant she was as she died. And she had withered away to next to nothing. But she made it so easy for all of us to go through that. It was a profound lesson that, you know, she accepted it, knew it was coming, and wanted us to all be comfortable with that. And she talked about it. That was a great thing. Mm. She talked about it, and she wasn't afraid to talk about it. So she made it okay for everybody else to say what they needed to say.
So there's, you know, we keep the communication tool in the beginner course because that communication is an antidote to stress, right?
Yeah. It was
and obviously,
so different. So different from what my dad, my mom and dad were going through. So
that's
different.
A great tip for people who are listening, right? To create forums for open communication about what's going on really can reduce the stress of it for everyone and bring dignity, as you said.
And, you know, Carl is, Chris's dad has had a hard time, but I think in retrospect he's had a much easier time than my dad has had. Because he's also, because of that's the way they ran their family, he's got, you know, his children still come in and see him nearly every day. And, you know, he comes over for supper and they're watching out for him and he's still in his home. And he had, the ugliness of Alzheimer's is that it's like a walking death. It's, and not that my mom can walk anymore because she can't, but it's like you're watching someone who's alive, but they're dead. They're not there. Whereas another kind of passing would be far better. And it's really, you know, I so anyway, continue.
Well, can I pause you there for a second? Since you've got some of the tools, right? So you just said another kind of passing would be far better. So what if you just take a moment, Lisa, and do the neutral tool that you learned in the beginner course?
I am already.
Yeah, so go to neutral. Maybe even do quick coherence, right? And look at that from your heart's point of view and see, is your heart really partial to one way of passing or another? It might be, but this sounded like a judgment in there that I'm curious if your heart has a different perspective.
Well, it is because it's so hard on everybody else. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you're right, it's the way you react to things, not
the way you look at it and respond. You know,
exactly.
One of the books I want to recommend on tonight's call for people who are listening is a fabulous book by Ram Dass called Still Here. You know, he wrote Be Here Now in the 60s, and he had a very severe stroke and wrote a book from his stroke called Still Here. And it's just amazing for anybody who's dealing with someone, you know, with a challenge like this, and like Alzheimer's or having had a stroke or anything like that at all. He describes in the book, because he talks about aging and dying as a fabulous heart experience, which sounds, it's totally contradictory to how we're conditioned to look at it, right? But one of my favorite, I'm going to cry myself, one of my favorite chapters in this book probably touched me so much, of course, because I watched my grandmother go through Alzheimer's, is a chapter where he tells the story of a woman who comes down with Alzheimer's. And her daughter is her caretaker, and it gets to that point, like you described, Lisa, where it's, too far gone and you can't take care of them anymore. And she finds a home for her mother. And the home tells her, okay, you're going to bring her here tomorrow. It's that day, right? They're at the day. And the home says, don't bring any photographs. Don't. She can have the clothes that she's wearing, but don't bring any clothing, any of her clothing. Don't bring any of her belongings. And the woman that Ram Dass is interviewing for this says, you know, my God, I just felt like this is so cruel. They're completely robbing her of her identity. And she just felt devastated, right? She couldn't sleep at all the night before she's taking her mother in. And she follows the rules, but she's like, how can this be? This is cruelty. This is medieval. She gets to the home, and they take her mother in the other room, and they say, thank you so much for bringing her, and we're just going to give her some new clothing, and we'll meet you back here. And she's like, she can't even keep the clothing she wore that day. And so they give her new clothing, and they gave her mother a brand new pocketbook. So interesting, right? She's obviously not going to need a pocketbook inside the nursing home. They gave her a brand new pocketbook with a little, you know, like a leather loop on the end. And this woman comes out, the woman who had Alzheimer's, and her daughter says she, you know, didn't recognize her daughter anymore. The last moment that her daughter saw her mother, she was wearing all new clothes, and she was swinging the new pocketbook on her pinky, walking down the hall, singing, I'm free, I'm free, I'm free. That one story completely changed my perception of Alzheimer's as a disease. And that, you know, we get so identified with the characters and the roles that we play in these lifetimes. But in fact, you know, someone who has Alzheimer's, their mind isn't there. Their sense of identity, their memory, the ego that they've built through the years is unwinding. But there's still a heart there. And the heart of this woman could experience that heartfelt fear, a feeling of freedom. So I just have it as a question mark from my own sense of neutrality, from my own use of the tools, right? As to whether we could really say that one way of dying is better than another, right?
Well,
everything that happens, this is what I'm a stand for and what we teach, that everything that happens is actually an opportunity for us to deepen in the heart.
My thing is, it's certainly easier to go around you.
Hey, listen, I don't wish nightmare situations on anybody.
Yeah.
But if we've got them,
you
got
to deal with it.
We may as well use them.
Yeah.
To get deeper in the heart, because that's where the payoffs are. Or at least it's, you know, a good treasure chest to open up. So I would love it, Lisa, if inside of that possibility you would share what happened.
Yes, in the summer.
Yeah, after you came to me when, I get that's it. I was
August.
Home for the summer, right?
I was home for the summer, and it was August before I went back off to Toronto. And I had received, I knew I was at the brink of stress. I couldn't cry anymore. I was wired. I couldn't sleep. My hair was falling out. The back of my head looked like, thank God the top of my hair never fell out, but the back of my head looked like someone had just taken a razor and just sliced the hair right off the back of my head. It was bald.
Mm.
And it was...
Again, you guys, can you feel your own compassion for this? So important.
And I, so I knew I was just, I had to change something. Something had to change. I could not continue that way anymore. And so Sheva came home and wanted to do an introductory lesson, an introductory lecture. So I went to her mom's house and sat there. And she was there for a few more days. And then I did the introductory lecture. And then I had to go off to Toronto again. And just before I got there, or actually just before Sheva had arrived in Nova Scotia, I had got a panic phone call from my sister that my dad was in hospital because he had tried to commit suicide. So I knew what I was heading up to because when I arrived, he was still in the psychiatric assessment ward. And I drove in. I stayed with a friend who lived close by. I did not want to stay in their house alone at that point. I stayed with a friend, had my rental car, and we got Dad a weekend pass. And it was a very strange event for me because there I was in the psychiatric ward of the hospital at one end of the city. And Toronto goes on for miles like L.A. It just goes on for half the province. It's unbelievable. And on one of the busiest highways in the country, just bumper to bumper at breakneck speeds. And I was trying to keep myself calm. And I was just going to neutral and doing quick coherence the whole time. Just the whole time. Going, I can do this. I can stay calm. I can do this. You know, just like stay calm. Just go get Dad, bring him home for the weekend. And I went into the hospital. I had to, you know, sign him out with his medication. And here I was. Now I was my dad's keeper officially. I had signed documents. I was my dad's keeper. Took him home and then went to the next day, got my dad to his house, and the next day went to visit my mom for the first time in the nursing home since she had been there. And I knew when I got there that she would not know who I was. I knew that. It really didn't prepare me for it, though. And so quite a lot of the time I was, again, going to neutral, breathing, you know. And when I got there, she was with my dad to visit for the first time. She refused to get out of bed. She just kept lying on the top of her bed saying, I'm so tired.
Hold on one second, Lisa. Mm-hmm. We're just getting a lot of background noise from somebody maybe who joined us late. If you could *6 to mute your phone, that would be great.
I don't think they can hear you. Anyway, I'll continue. I'll speak
all
louder.
All right, yeah. In a moment, I'll just have to mute everyone out, which unfortunately will mute out the whole call. Oh. You lost him. Go ahead, Lisa.
Okay. So where was it? And Dad said, oh, there's no point being here. You know, he started to go into his rage. I said, Dad, no, there is. I came all this way. There is a point to being here. We can just look. There's two chairs. I've just driven all this way. You've just gotten out of the hospital. For goodness sakes, let's just sit, have a conversation, calm down. I do not want to get back in the traffic right now. And we'll just sit here and have a conversation. At least we'll be with her. You know, we can just be with her. We don't have to talk to her. We just have a conversation and enjoy the scenery out the window. And it was interesting because while we were there, she kept, although she didn't know who I was at all, there was no recognition. At least she didn't say it. She kept lifting her head while Dad and I were talking and looking at me. And I could tell increasingly that something in her was sensing that I was someone different, or I was someone she knew. I just knew she was confused and couldn't figure out who I was, and knew she was working at it. And finally a nurse did come in and help us manage to get her on her feet. And I said, let's go for a walk. And, you know, Dad took her by the arm, and she turned to me and she said, are you coming too? I said, well, of course I'm coming too. And she took me by the hand, and she said, you're nice. And when she said, you have to come for a walk with us. And so I said, okay. She would not let go of my hand. There was something in her that knew. And she eventually, I mean, it didn't last very long. We managed two, you know, quick loops of the corridor. And she went back and laid down in bed. And we had a bit more conversation. I had a bit more conversation with my dad. And at the end, as we were leaving, because it was, you know, time for her supper, she said to me, are you coming back? And I said, yes, well, I'll come back tomorrow. And she says, that's good. I love you. And she didn't know my name, but she knew she loved me. And it was actually a very profound thing. Probably better than having a conversation with her. And it amazed me that in the midst of all that, even when she didn't have her mind, couldn't feed herself anymore, couldn't read, didn't know who anybody was, she could still express herself that way. And so that was probably going to be my last contact with my mom, because now she's become nonverbal. She most recently, a few weeks ago, just had, they think she had a stroke, a small stroke, and so now she's wheelchair bound and really can't feed herself anymore. So we're preparing that the end is very near. So, but that was a great way to have my last communication with my mom.
So powerful.
So, you know,
I just love that story, Lisa. When I hear you describe it, what it brings to mind the research they've done on heart transplant patients. And there was a little boy who fell off of a balcony chasing a Power Ranger. And he was like 6 years old, I think, and he fell something like 100 stories down and died, of course. And his parents donated his heart to another little boy that needed a transplant. And the mother, of course, I mean, imagine, here we go, right? The opposite direction, right? You feel responsible for your father, you're responsible for your kids. You can imagine how guilty that mother felt, right? Just devastated and was a complete wreck for a year. And the organ donor agency that organized the transplant had it so that those parents who donated the organs of their children could meet the children who received them a year after recovery. And she arrived at the play group or playroom where the transplant patients were. And she didn't even have to say anything. The little boy that received her son's heart recognized her.
Wow.
And he was normally a shy little boy, and he crawled up into her lap and refused to go anywhere. And she asked him if she could listen to his heart. And she put her ear against his chest and listened to his heart, and she said it was the first time that she felt peace since her son had died. This intrinsic connection of who we are goes beyond our personalities and even our bodies. And as you said, you know, it was better than having a conversation with her.
Yep.
Sometimes the personality just is static to the real connection.
And should you hear any background noise from my end of the line, it's because my daughter and her friend are having a sleepover.
There you go.
There it is. It's like, oh... But interestingly, since that's happened, since my dad had his crisis, you know, he's got better control. I think he's very, very lucky to, excuse me a moment, Sheva, I'm sorry. I got to shut up, quiet down these 12-year-olds. Hold on.
Perfect example, live and in action, of the sandwich generation.
Okay.
Well, definitely tell Becca I said hi. She's such a fabulous chat. We still need to work out this curriculum we planned in December.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing, too, though, my daughter's great. She's not work yet. But we've always had a very close relationship, and we talk a lot, and we've always talked about anything and everything. So... you know, the day will come when she keeps secrets from me, but, you know, I can probably, most of that hasn't happened yet. But she's very great kid to be around.
Yeah, well, and she's handled all this really well.
Really well, yeah.
I want to open up the call before we close up the call in case anybody wants to share their own story with us, Lisa, or in case anybody wants to ask you questions, right?
Here's one interesting thing, and you talked about this earlier, is that when my dad called me to say that, you know, mom had had a stroke, and he says, I'm really worried about her, and he was getting himself worked up. I could tell he was getting himself worked up again. And I said, Dad, what are you going to worry about? She said, well, your mother and her health. I said, Dad, I just have to, you know, say this, that it's okay to be sad. It's okay to mourn her loss. But if you worry, there's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can change by worrying. You're just going to have to go with the flow and be sad, cry, you know, mourn her loss. But getting yourself agitated and worrying isn't going to do anything because it's still going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
It's still going to be happening. And that's the one thing that I think, and it came out of me very quickly, and I'm not sure it would have before. I would have tried to have fixed it.
Mm.
I'm a good fixer, a good problem solver. And I think I would have tried to have fixed it and created more stress for myself. But it just came out of me. And it was a very unusual response for me because I'm one of those warrior types who just gets out in front and just kind of hacks away, you know, out in front of the pack, taking all the hits.
Mm.
And it was actually very, I think it sort of helped them at that point in time. It certainly helped me. So, you know, I just wanted to put that out, that it has changed the way I'm starting to respond to things.
Well, and you can see then there's a cascading effect in that it changes how your dad is responding to
mm-hmm.
things. You are a better support to him, and in turn, he's less of a stress for you.
And, you know, I think it's also one thing I did say, Dad, you know, if going and seeing Mom every day is that stressful on you, why don't you just go every second day? Why don't you take some time for yourself to do other things? And interestingly, and I kept trying to encourage, he started to volunteer for Big Brothers and Sisters. He's starting to do what I think are more,
their investments of his time and energy
yeah.
that have more payoff for his own yeah. Tiara, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They're not investments of his time and energy that have dead-end results.
Dead-end results. And he seems so much better.
I'm so thrilled to hear that, Lisa, because
yeah.
I haven't really gotten those updates. So you see how your own coherence
yeah.
in practicing the tools becomes an exponentially expanding ripple effect. Think of the
yeah.
kids now that are benefiting from your dad. It's just,
yeah.
it's such a win-win-win for everybody.
Yeah.
Let's open up the line because
mm-hmm.
we're already going a bit over time, and I want to
mm-hmm.
just, if anybody has any questions for Lisa or for me or any story of your own that you want to share, just press *6 to unmute yourself before you talk or we won't hear you. I think we've shocked them all into silence.
I don't know. Please.
Well, if there aren't any questions or no sharing that anyone else has, is there anything else, Lisa, that you would want to say to somebody else who's going through what you're going through right now?
Hmm. Well, I think the big thing is just what I've learned from the heart mass is just greater acceptance.
Mm.
And that has been a great relief for me, that there are just some things in life you cannot change.
Mm.
And how you choose to deal with that is what makes the difference. You know, you either find a positive way to get through it, or it can tie you up in knots and sometimes almost destroy you.
Mm.
And those things are still going to happen. So it makes a huge difference.
Well, and that is such a beautiful segue into being able to say that the tools that Lisa's referring to as heart math, you can learn through Fiera. We have a beginner webinar starting on April 4th, I believe. If you go to our website, which is Fiera, F like fantastic, Y-E-R-A.com, you can sign up for that webinar. The free version or the full 4-week version you can purchase in the store, either for the in-person courses or for recording online. And We do these Heart Start calls every Monday night. We also have a year-long program called Heart Mastery, and the technology which can measure your heart rhythm in real time and coach you into that zone that's empowering Lisa, as you can hear, to go into a place of greater acceptance, greater flow and peace, and even finding moments of gem moments in trying situations. So there are tools and resources for this, and if you're interested in that, you can definitely access them through our website, or you can call us directly at 310-581-1507. Or you can email us info@Fiera, F like fantastic, Y-E-R-A.com. And again, our next beginner webinar, which begins, I'll actually get the proper date here for it, on, it's not April 4th, it's April Fool's Day. The next webinar, April Fool's Day. Okay, good. Well, we'll have to make that one extra fun. Add some surprises. And for those who are listening to this as a recording, we do free beginner webinars every the first Tuesday of every month. You can always register for those through our website. And we also do these free Heart Start calls every Monday, and you can sign up to get the information about that too. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I truly appreciate it. And as you know, appreciate you so much. I gave you credit in the invitation that went out for this call, that it was really the discipline and the payoff of commitment that you taught me in ballet that has allowed me to reap the benefits of committing to and disciplining myself to use the heart and given me the foundation to offer it to other people. So I want to acknowledge you with every fiber of my being.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Lisa. That was great. Thank you very much. I'll tell you, I'm facing that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. John.
Yeah.
Thank you all who joined us here tonight. And I look forward to next week's call. Good night, everyone.
Night.
Night.